Welcome to the Legal Nurse Podcast, where you'll get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside the legal nurse consulting business. They'll share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with over 30 years' experience. So join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's your host, Pat Iyer.
Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast. This is Pat Iyer, and we are talking today with Colleen Sweeney, who is a nurse, and the topic is patient fears. Colleen is a skilled communicator who instantly wins over her audiences. Having spent a lifetime in hospitals as a nursing student, nursing aide, nursing assistant, graduate nurse, registered nurse, educator, manager, and director, Colleen knows healthcare from many different aspects. For the past 12 years, she held positions as director of innovation and director of ambassador and customer services at a hospital system in Indiana. She concentrates on the patient experience, and she conducted a 3-year study about patient fears. Her research is called the Patient Empathy Project, and this made her the nation's thought leader in truly patient-centered care. Colleen and I met through our involvement in the National Speakers Association. She is a certified facilitator with the Tom Peters Company and recently earned her Certified Speaker Professional designation. She founded Sweeney Healthcare Enterprises, and Colleen is on a mission to transform healthcare, which is certainly something that we focus on as legal nurse consultants, seeing the pitfalls in the healthcare system as it exists today. But Colleen has a background in nursing and in business and a master's certificate in project management, and also has done improv comedy. Her time on the stage doing improv taught her to build enthusiasm, think differently about the work she does, and pull audiences into the power of possibility within themselves. Colleen, welcome to the show. I'm so glad that we could set aside this time to talk.
Thank you, Pat. I'm just thrilled to be here. Thank you.
I know when I first met you and you handed me your business card, on the back of your business card was a list of patient fears. First of all, could you share with us what is the prevalence of patient fears?
Well, 96% of all patients have some fear around their hospitalization, but they rarely tell us. So, and I sometimes think that maybe that 4% are not telling the truth, but 96% is what my 3.5-year study showed, that they have some concern, concern at the least, but probably fear around some part of the process. So almost everyone.
Could you share with us what are the top 11 fears that patients in the hospital experience?
Sure. Well, I did an interview study, and I interviewed 1,080 persons. So, and I can't tell you why 1,080, not that it was a magic number or anything, but I did an interview study, and I asked patients about their greatest fear in the hospital. And I arrived, when I was done, I thought maybe I had arrived at a top 10 list, but 11 was so interesting to me that I felt like I just could not leave it out. So the number one fear by far is the fear of infection, that patients fear that they will not leave the hospital, that they will leave the hospital with something they did not come in with, or won't leave the hospital as a result of a hospital-acquired infection. And it's very interesting because patients know about MRSA, and they know about C. diff, and we'll talk about them. So I don't know if that's because of family, friends, television, but are very, very much aware and will rarely point it out to us if we have not washed our hands, but it is top of mind for many, many patients. So infection was by far number one, followed by incompetent that doctors or nurses or those who have their hand in the care process may not know what they're doing or what is best for them. Third is death, and I honestly believe that death is probably maybe at the basis for every fear. So when we say number one is infection, that people fear that they are going to die of an infection. So death was number three, followed very closely by cost, which is very interesting because that is something that we rarely as clinicians take up with caregivers. It's just not our business, and we don't really know what things are going to cost. I think it would be interesting to ask nurses and even physicians what they think the cost of some equipment would be or supplies, and it's something that we rarely discuss with patients, but it's top of mind for them. Medical mix-ups was number five, that maybe they would have a wrong site surgery or that there would be a medication or something to that effect, and it's probably a very founded fear. Number six was needles, and it was number one for males under the age of 25. Almost every fear will go back to childhood, and needles is one that is especially that's true for. And in asking people about their fear of needles, almost every adult could go back to a childhood memory where they got an injection. And I can think of one gentleman I interviewed where he said to the doctor as a six-year-old, any more shots today? Or am I going to get any shots today? And the doctor said no, and then surprised him and gave him a shot. And he said to this day, and he happens to be a clinician, and he said he doesn't have any problem giving them, but getting them is a big problem for him where he passes out. Rude doctors and nurses are number seven. Germs were number eight. Diagnosis, prognosis, fear of what their diagnosis prognosis would be is number nine. Communication issues in general was number 10. And number 11 is loneliness. So, like any research, trends begin to develop, and I noticed that many, many times foreign-born persons would say, to be lonely in the hospital is the worst thing. And it's interesting because I have a medical mission and have done some work both in Kenya and India. And for them, for people in those countries to be sick and alone is probably the worst thing that can happen to them because it's family members' sacred duty to come and cook for, at least in Kenya, in some smaller villages, that where they would cook for the patient. There are no meals supplied. And so they actually have a hand in the care. And then when they come to the States, many times we will say it's 8:30, visiting hours are over. So that is the top 11 list of what patients fear in the hospital setting.
Your story about cooking in the hospital reminds me of making a trip to India shortly after I got married and going into a hospital where my husband's brother was a physician. We happened to be there at mealtime, and there was a 50 to 60 bed hospital ward. It was all one open room, and they had a stretcher, and they were going down the rows of the beds and throwing bags of milk to the patient and slices of bread, and that was the only food that the hospital would supply, and their relatives slept on the floor, on the bare floor, under the hospital bed.
Oh, that's amazing. Still happens today in Kenya, and it's what they would call one of their finest hospitals. There'll be 30 pediatric patients in a room and family members almost on every square inch of the floor, and only one meal is served by the hospital, and it's almost like a porridge that's served in the morning, but all the other meals, it's up to the family members to cook, so they'll cook over an open flame outside. It's amazing. And then our, of course, in the States, people will complain that they don't like the food.
That's right.
To them, you know? It's just a matter of perspective.
It's all your perspective.
Absolutely.
So you interviewed over 1,000 people. How did you get involved in doing this kind of research?
Oh, that's very interesting. It was not intentional at all on my part. I probably about 14, 15 years ago, I was given the title of Director of Customer Service. So at the time, Patient Experience Officer did not exist. And I was the very first one in my hospital ever to hold that position as what was then the Director of Customer Service, later became the Patient Experience Officer. And I didn't know where to begin because there weren't a lot of people who held that title in the country at that time. There were very few of us, as a matter of fact, probably less than 30. And I knew about the first 3 seconds, that the first 3 seconds of any interaction are important. And I wanted our front doors at the hospital covered by either volunteers or administrators, so I asked them to volunteer in the morning for about a half an hour so that every patient was greeted within the first 3 seconds, that people were walked to where they had to go. And it was one day when I was taking my turn and a lady came in and she was going to have back surgery and I took her by wheelchair. And I noticed that I was standing back where I could not hear her interaction with registration, but I noticed that her hands were shaking when she went for her insurance card and her ID. And so when she was done, I said, "Are you all right?" And she said, "No." She said, "The last 3 times I was at this hospital, the person that I was here with, they died."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "I'm so sorry. You know, when it comes to quality, we're one of the best." And she goes, "Oh, you did a great job. It was expected in every instance." She said, "But that's the only thought I have in my head when I pull into the parking lot." And I thought, oh my heavens, I've never given that thought, that people have like some preconceived idea of hospitals or some dread or a particular fear. And I thought, wow, every one of us is a prisoner of a past experience. And if your past experience with a hospital is good, then, you know, you think good things. And if it isn't, then not so much. And so I went back to my office and I asked my two assistants who were non-clinical, if you were to be a patient in your hospital, what would you fear? And immediately they told me what they would fear. And I thought, oh my heavens, what if every patient has some fear? And what if we found out what that fear was and we addressed it? Would it cause the experience to be different for patients, but then would it also cause the experience, the care experience, to be different for us? And so I began to interview patients and until I became like fascinated with what patients told me that they feared. It was, and I just kept going and going. And I mean, to this day, I still will interview people about what their biggest fears are. And I since have done a study around medical practices. So what do people fear about a medical practice, you know, a doctor's visit? So which the fears are way, way different.
Hmm.
So that's how it started. I was not intentional. And then someone from actually the Barrel Institute asked me their very first conference, would I speak about my study? And I thought, well, you know, that's kind of a crazy thing to speak about. And then it was someone in the audience who actually put it together, patient fears and HCAHPS, and that's how it started for me.
Wow. It's fascinating because I know that nurses and doctors encounter people who are anxious, but to have a study of the size of yours, that sample size is astounding, and to see all the commonalities is fascinating.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's still to this day. I mean, I lived it, and I still am fascinated. And even on a plane when, you know, and someone will say, "What do you do for a living?" "Oh, I'm a speaker. What do you speak about?" What patients fear in the hospital. And then they tell you a story, you know,
mm-hmm.
like everyone has
mm-hmm.
a story. So you know that it really strikes a chord with people.
Let's stop for a moment and think about the role of anticoagulants in causing injury. Even in the best of circumstances, when everyone does everything right, anticoagulation can lead to significant toxicity and bleeding, permanent injury, paralysis, blindness, and death. Safe use requires understanding of how they work, the mechanism of interaction, the onset and duration of action, using antidotes, and recognizing and avoiding drug interactions. The standard of care requires thorough and careful ordering, compounding, labeling, distributing, administering, and monitoring by healthcare workers. I have a one-hour online training called Anticoagulation, Teetering on the Bleeding Edge. Our clinical pharmacist, Dr. James O'Donnell, discusses the liability and damages associated with anticoagulation so that you know as an LNC how to analyze these cases. Order this video training at http://lnc.tips/anticoagulation and use the coupon code LISTENED to get a 25% discount. That address again is http://lnc.tips/anticoagulation. Now let's get back to our program. Well, some of our listeners work in the area of medical and nursing malpractice, meaning that they work with attorneys who handle those kinds of cases. Some of our listeners may be working clinically and are in contact with patients who would exhibit the fears that you have identified. I know from my work with plaintiff attorneys in the past that there is often an unhappy customer experience combined with a bad outcome that leads an individual to go see a plaintiff attorney to identify if that bad outcome is tied to incompetence or a medical error. The rudeness may be the factor that leads to the dissatisfaction combined with a bad outcome. We know that people who seek answers don't always get them from the hospital community. They may ask what went wrong, but they may not receive an honest answer despite ethical obligations to provide patients with explanations. So looking at incompetence, medical mix-ups and errors, and rude doctors and nurses, what comments do you have to say to our audience about those topics?
Well, I think that it's about relationships. You know, it's very much about relationships. And I think that maybe in the last couple, I don't actually want to put it on a timeline, but as of maybe the last 10 years, we have become very busy with tasks and less about the relationship, more about the computer and less about making eye contact with people. And finding common ground. And, you know, I'm sure that you know the statistics on this, but once people feel like you care about them and are not just caring for them, they will cut you quite a bit of slack. And things don't always go as planned. No one knows that better than you and your audience. Things don't always go as planned and they don't go perfectly. But I believe that if people know that you have their best interest at heart, that they have a tendency to be a lot more forgiving. But that comes down to communication. It comes down to, finding common ground with the patient. It comes down to how you were perceived in the very first minutes of the care experience. All of those things. And, you know, and communication is huge. I mean, it's huge. And so a funny thing is that sometimes I will say, when I speak, I'll say, why do you think to nursing audiences, why do you think we don't routinely ask patients about their biggest fear? And they'll say, well, because they'll start talking to us and we'll be stuck in the room with them.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. I think, oh my heavens, that's the very reason I went into nursing. And I know that it's tough. tough, and I know that anymore it's task-oriented, but I believe that we have to put the patient back in the center of the care model and stop busying ourselves with all of the things that we're chasing, you know, such as HCAP domains. All of those things have taken us way, way off track.
So the communication sounds like to be
huge.
Such an essential thing. And as you were talking, I was thinking about people who don't have English as their native language, who are trying to communicate with healthcare providers who may not have English as their native language either, and the importance of being able to communicate with patients to understand their fears or give them some reality-based information that will help them in their expectations, and also simple explanations that will help make the actions of the healthcare providers understandable, since there's just so many opportunities to misunderstand each other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it becomes very complex. So I do quite a bit of consulting, and I have some clients actually outside of New York City. And one night I was in I was shadowing a nurse manager, and there was an emergency in the room, and I looked around, and there were 7 people in the room. Not 2 were of the same nationality. And I think, oh my heavens, to include the patient. And I thought, wow, it's so complex and so layered. And, you know, you have communication on the part of the patient, and then, you know, and then you have communication on the part of a diverse nursing staff or clinical staff, I should say. And so it becomes very complex, very, very complex in many, many situations. And how do you do that? And I recently have started to do an exercise with audience that I call the Rip Van Winkle exercise. I actually learned it through the Cleveland Clinic, some physicians at the Cleveland Clinic. And I have audiences pair up and have them, one is the explainer, the other one, the other person pretends that they have been asleep for 200 years. And the explainer has to explain some things, and I have these things on a card, such as a vacuum cleaner, an iPhone, a flat screen TV, an airplane ticket. And so they have just one thing that they have to explain to this person who's been asleep for 200 years, and it's almost impossible, an almost impossible feat. And my point is, they'll say, that was so hard. And she kept saying, what's electric? And, you know, what's a screen and whatever? And I say, that is absolutely how difficult it is for us to explain things to a patient who has no clinical background. You know, it becomes very, very complex and almost impossible because we speak a totally different language. That's just with medicine. And then on top of that, you have language barriers. So, you know, the fact that we have outcomes as good as they are in most cases is really amazing. Very complex.
Do you see changes occurring in the healthcare system to address these fears?
Yes, most definitely. So it's something that we haven't talked about. It's probably never been talked about. And I see organizations, and I feel like I'll take it however I can get it, but I most definitely feel as though there is a huge push for relationship-based care and to train people in empathy, if that's at all possible, to increase empathy in the care process. And the fact that I am busy all of the time and booked a year out tells me a lot about what people are thinking and what's important to them. And, you know, I hate to say this, but I honestly believe that had I done this study, so HCAPS has been out now 10 years. They just had their 10-year anniversary or whatever of HCAPS. Had I done this study 20 years ago, I don't think anyone would have cared, honestly. And now, because of the advent of HCAHPS and that people want to move their scores and are looking for, relationship-based care, I honestly believe that whatever the incentive is, maybe it's reimbursement, maybe it is purely because of HCAHPS, I believe that now people are really frantically looking to how do we develop that relationship with patients and how do we find common ground, those kind of things. How do we empathize? So, yes, I believe that I'm not sure what the incentive is, and I want to think the best, but, yes, I believe that people are reaching out, and obviously we have found ways, my organization has found ways that we ask the question and address the fear, and we do it electronically. So, and we're able to track all of those fears within specialties and subspecialties.
And in such a brief length of stay, it sounds like every interaction counts.
Oh, absolutely. You know, every interaction counts. And the amazing thing is, it can be with volunteers, nursing assistants. I don't think people really differentiate, how they're made to feel. They don't really care who it is. And so everyone has to be on board because every interaction counts in a huge way.
I know that healthcare is putting a great emphasis now on teamwork, the flattening of the organization, of having doctors and nurses and other healthcare providers all communicating in a more collaborative way with less emphasis on the hierarchy. Do you see those changes as being helpful with patient fears?
I do. I'm not sure we're there yet. I mean, I think that I think that it's a great thought. I still think that it is fairly layered. I honestly believe that the hardest job in healthcare is the nurse manager who is caught in between.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have huge responsibilities. I do believe that managers and directors are now at the bedside with leader rounds. So, yes, I think that all of those things are moving towards improvement, but we're not there yet. We have a long way to go, let's say.
Mm-hmm. I know, and then you add in the reducing numbers of registered nurses who are available to take care of patients because of the nursing shortage, which will only accelerate. And it puts a lot of emphasis on having highly skilled technicians who also know how to communicate in an effective way, because they're often the ones that the patients are going to be able to see more frequently than a professional.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's I'm not quite sure where it's all going. I don't like to think about it too much because I will be on the receiving end of that care just as that crisis should be hitting its boiling point. So it's going to get very interesting. And I do think we have to rethink our model.
Well, that's a good point. Everyone who's listening to this is simultaneously a healthcare provider, but also a patient and sees it from both perspectives.
Absolutely.
I wanted to switch subjects with you for the remaining couple of minutes because you're involved in something that I think is absolutely fascinating, and that is the REMA project. Could you tell our listeners what that's all about?
Well, thank you for asking about it. Maybe 9 years ago, was asked to be on the board of directors for the REMA project, and it's when I lived in Indiana and I became acquainted with a gentleman who is actually an Aflac salesman, and he became involved with Habitat for Humanity, went to India, and was sitting in a truck in a van one day outside of a gas station. And he watched a family pass in front of his van, and the mother was holding a wet blanket, and she was crying, and there were two children and the husband. And he said to his driver, what's happening there? And he said, oh, they drowned their baby girl. And he said that's a very common practice in villages because they don't have a dowry for their girls and can't afford to support a girl. And so girls are not as valued in India. And so this gentleman, who is an Aflac salesman, just a guy from Indiana, said, not as long as I'm alive. And so what he did was he vowed to save the life of the Indian girl child. I think people thought he was crazy. Well, it's an amazing thing because he started in about, a couple years into it, maybe 17 villages. And now he's pretty much, I think that maybe we're up to about 60 villages now. And so what happened is he raised the value of the girl child in small villages, and word spread, and the very first girl who he saved her life, her name was Rima, which is a very common, which is a common Indian name. And so the project started that way, and I have been involved since the inception. But what happened is when we saved the life of baby girls, then there also is a shortage of food and not enough classroom space, and it got very, compounded a lot of problems and created a lot of problems. And so right now we have, I'll call it a campus. It's in Salem in the southern part of India, and it is an orphanage and a nursing program, and that's what I'm very involved in. So we train girls to be nursing assistants, and then those nursing assistants, which really elevates the value of the Indian girl, and then those girls are specifically chosen from villages. They go back to villages and they carry the message, because obviously we cannot be in all of these villages. So that is our plan. So I am very heavily involved in raising money to educate the Indian girl, and as a nursing assistant, and our equivalent of a nursing assistant. And so so it's a huge project, but I just recently, in the last 6 months, decided I always have people who will ask me about it when I speak, and they ever say, you know, they'll say, if you ever are taking people, I'd like to go. And so I just opened it up for the very first time to audiences and those that follow me on social media. And we pretty much in 2 days filled the entire trip. So we're taking 18 people to India to work in on a medical mission there. And it will be the end of January, beginning of February. It'll be a 10 or 12 day trip. And so everyone's applying for their visas now, and that might be the toughest part. But so we're very excited about that, because I want to expose as many people as I possibly can to the project, and raise the awareness of, female infanticide. And there's lots of work to be done there. And so I have had people say to me, okay, so you work to support a mission, and you work in a mission in India when there's so much work to be done here. I actually have had people who have said that to me, who have been fairly critical. And I have things that I support here in the States, but I will tell you that when you get there, and they are so appreciative, you know, that a $320 education can change their life and all those that will come after them and their family. I mean, there is no appreciation that I have ever seen here stateside. So anyway, it's an awesome project, and I work to support that project. So there you go. That's the Rima Project.
Well, thank you, Colleen. That's really inspiring. Tell us how listeners can learn more about you.
If you Google patient fears, I think I'm the only one that comes up. So I think I'm the only one who's ever studied, I'm pretty sure the only one who's ever studied what patients fear. So it's patientfears.com or SweeneyHealthcareEnterprises.com or Colleen Sweeney. any of those things will bring up my website, and you can go on. You can read about the REMA project, and there's a lot of video on my site. There's ways that you can contribute in big or small ways, and so there's a lot on my website that people can where people can find out about both my medical mission and what patients fear.
Well, thank you so much, Colleen, for being part of this program. And for our listeners, please leave a comment. I'll provide a review on iTunes for this show. Stay tuned. We'll be back next week with another interview. And thanks for your comments and paying attention. Use the code LISTENED to get a 25% discount on this product. You'll put that code LISTENED in the coupon code box during checkout.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on iTunes. We always are interested in your ideas for new topics. Please leave a comment on legalnursepodcasts.com. Join our community and get notified of each new episode and receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on legalnursepodcasts.com. We appreciate you and your interest.